But despite all of his personal charm and persuasiveness, which was considerable, Shackleton was disappointed time after time by promised grants of financial aid, which failed to materialize. He finally obtained some $120,000 from Sir James Caird, a wealthy Scottish jute manufacturer, and the government voted him a sum equal to about $50,000, while the Royal Geographical Society contributed a token $5,000 to signify its general, though by no means complete, approval of the expedition. Lesser gifts were obtained from Dudley Docker and Miss Janet Stancombe Wills, plus literally hundreds of other smaller contributions from persons all over the world. As was the custom, Shackleton also mortgaged the expedition, in a sense, by selling in advance the rights to whatever commercial properties the expedition might produce. He promised to write a book later about the trip. He sold the rights to the motion pictures and still photographs that would be taken, and he agreed to give a long lecture series on his return. In all these arrangements, there was one basic assumption: that Shackleton would survive. In contrast to the difficulties in obtaining sufficient financial backing, finding volunteers to take part in the expedition proved simple. When Shackleton announced his plans, he was deluged by more than 5,000 applications from persons, including three girls, who asked to go along. Almost without exception, these volunteers were motivated solely by the spirit of adventure, for the salaries offered were little more than token payments for the services expected. They ranged from about $240 a year for an able seaman to $750 a year for the most experienced scientists, and even this, in many cases, was not to be paid until the end of the expedition. Shackleton felt that the privilege of being taken along was itself almost compensation enough, especially for the scientists for whom the undertaking offered an unmatched opportunity for research in their fields. Shackleton built the crew list round a nucleus of tested veterans. The top post, as second in command, went to Frank Wilde, a very small but powerfully built man whose thin, mousy hair was rapidly disappearing altogether. Wilde was a soft-spoken and easy-going individual on the surface, but he had a kind of inner toughness. He had been one of Shackleton's three companions in the race for the pole in 1908 and 1909, and Shackleton had developed a tremendous respect and personal liking for him. The two men, in fact, formed a well-matched team. Wilde's loyalty to Shackleton was beyond question, and his quiet, somewhat unimaginative disposition was a perfect balance for Shackleton's often whimsical and occasionally explosive nature. The berth of second officer aboard the Endurance was given to Thomas Crean, a tall, raw-boned, plain-spoken Irishman whose long service in the Royal Navy had taught him the ways of unquestioning discipline. Crean had served with Shackleton on Scott's 1901 expedition, and had also been a crewman aboard the Terra Nova, which had carried Scott's ill-fated 1910 to 1913 group to the Antarctic. Because of Crean's experience and strength, Shackleton planned to have him as the driver of a sledge team in the six-man transcontinental party. Alfred Cheetham, who shipped aboard as third officer, was Crean's opposite in appearance. He was a tiny man, even shorter than Wilde, with an unassuming, pleasant disposition. Shackleton spoke of Cheetham as the veteran of Antarctic, since he had already been on three expeditions, including one with Shackleton and one with Scott. Then there was George Marston, the expedition's 32-year-old artist. Marston, a boyish-faced, chubby man, had done outstanding work on Shackleton's 1907 to 1909 trek. Unlike most of the others, he was a married man with children. The nucleus of veterans was completed when Thomas MacLeod, a member of the 1907-1909 expedition, was signed on the Endurance as a seaman. In the matter of selecting newcomers, Shackleton's methods would appear to have been almost capricious. If he liked the look of a man, he was accepted. If he didn't, the matter was closed. And these decisions were made with lightning speed. There is no record of any interview that Shackleton conducted with a prospective expedition member lasting much more than 5 minutes. Leonard Hussey, an irrepressible, peppery little individual, was signed on as meteorologist, even though he had practically no qualifications for the position at the time. Shackleton simply thought Hussey looked funny, and the fact that he had recently returned from an expedition as an anthropologist to the torrid Sudan appealed to Shackleton's sense of whimsy. Hussey immediately took an intensive course in meteorology and later proved to be very proficient. Dr. Alexander Macklin, one of the two surgeons, caught Shackleton's fancy by replying, when Shackleton asked him why he was wearing glasses, "Many a wise face would look foolish without spectacles." And Reginald James was signed on as physician after Shackleton inquired about the state of his teeth, whether he suffered from varicose veins, if he was good-tempered, and if he could sing. At this last question, James looked puzzled.
"Oh, I don't mean any Caruso stuff," Shackleton reassured him. "But I suppose you can shout a bit with the boys."
Despite the instantaneous nature of these decisions, Shackleton's intuition for selecting compatible men rarely failed. The early months of 1914 were spent acquiring the countless items of equipment, stores, and gear that would be needed. Sledges were designed and tested in the snow-covered mountains of Norway. A new type of rations, intended to prevent scurvy, was tried out, as were specially designed tents. By the end of July 1914, however, everything had been collected, tested, and stowed aboard the Endurance. She sailed from London's East India docks on August the 1st. But the tragic political events of these dramatic days not only eclipsed the departure of the Endurance, but even threatened the whole venture. Archduke Ferdinand of Austria had been assassinated on June the 28th, and exactly 1 month later, Austria-Hungary declared war on Serbia. The powder trail was lighted. While the Endurance lay anchored at the mouth of the Thames River, Germany declared war on France. Then, on the very day that George V presented Shackleton with the Union Jack to carry on the expedition, Britain declared war on Germany. Shackleton's position could hardly have been worse. He was damned if he did, and damned if he didn't. He was just about to leave on an expedition he had dreamed about and worked toward for almost 4 years. Vast sums of money, much of it involving future commitments, had been spent, and countless hours had gone into planning and preparation. At the same time, he felt very strongly about doing his part in the war. He spent long hours debating what to do, and he discussed the matter with several advisers, notably his principal backers. Finally, he reached a decision. He mustered the crew and explained that he wanted their approval to telegraph the Admiralty, placing the entire expedition at the disposal of the government. All hands agreed, and the wire was sent. The reply was a one-word telegram: "Proceed." 2 hours later, there was a longer wire from Winston Churchill, then First Lord of the Admiralty, stating that the government desired the expedition to go on. The Endurance sailed from Plymouth 5 days later. She set course for Buenos Aires, leaving Shackleton and Wilde behind to attend to last-minute financial arrangements. They were to follow later by faster commercial liner and meet the ship in Argentina. The trip across the Atlantic amounted to a shakedown cruise. For the ship, it was her first major voyage since her completion in Norway the year before, and for many of those on board, it was their first experience in sail. In appearance, the Endurance was beautiful by any standards. She was a barkentine, three masts of which the forward one was square-rigged, while the after two carried fore and aft sails like a schooner. She was powered by a coal-fired 350-horsepower steam engine capable of driving her at speeds up to 10.2 knots. She measured 144 feet overall with a 25-foot beam, which was not over big, but big enough. And though her sleek black hull looked from the outside like that of any other vessel of a comparable size, it was not. Her keel members were four pieces of solid oak, one above the other, adding up to a total thickness of 7 feet 1 inch. Her sides were made from oak and Norwegian mountain fir, and they varied in thickness from about 18 inches to more than 2.5 feet. Outside this planking, to keep her from being chafed by the ice, there was a sheathing from stem to stern of greenheart, a wood so heavy it weighs more than solid iron, and so tough that it cannot be worked with ordinary tools. Her frames were not only double thick, ranging from 9 1/4 to 11 inches, but they were double in number compared with a conventional vessel. Her bow, where she would meet the ice head-on, had received special attention. Each of the timbers there had been fashioned from a single oak tree, especially selected so that its natural growth followed the curve of her design. When assembled, these pieces had a total thickness of 4 feet 4 inches. But more than simple ruggedness was incorporated into the Endurance. She was built in Sandefjord, Norway, by the Framnes Shipyard, the famous polar shipbuilding firm which for years had been constructing vessels for whaling and sealing in the Arctic and Antarctic. However, when the builders came to the Endurance, they realized that she might well be the last of her kind, as indeed she was, and the ship became the yard's pet project. She was designed by Anderud Larsen, so that every joint and every fitting cross-braced something else for the maximum strength. Her construction was meticulously supervised by a master wood shipbuilder, Christian Jacobsen, who insisted on employing men who were not only skilled shipwrights, but had been to sea themselves in whaling and sealing ships. They took a proprietary interest in the smallest details of the Endurance's construction. They selected each timber and plank individually with great care and fitted each to the closest tolerance. For luck, when they put the mast in her, the superstitious shipwrights placed the traditional copper krona under each one to ensure against its breaking. By the time she was launched on December 17, 1912, she was the strongest wooden ship ever built in Norway, and probably anywhere else, with the possible exception of the Fram, the vessel used by Fridtjof Nansen and later by Amundsen. However, there was one major difference between the two ships. The Fram was rather bowl-bottomed, so that if the ice closed in against her, she would be squeezed up and out of the pressure. But since the Endurance was designed to operate in relatively loose pack ice, she was not constructed so as to rise out of pressure to any great extent. She was comparatively wall-sided, much the way conventional ships are. However, on the trip from London to Buenos Aires, her hull was altogether too rounded for most of those on board her. At least half the scientists were seasick, and strapping young Lionel Greenstreet, the outspoken first officer, who had long experience in sailing ships, declared that she behaved in a most abominable way. The trip across the Atlantic took more than 2 months. During the voyage, the Endurance was under the command of Frank Worsley, a New Zealander who had been to sea since he was 16. Worsley was now 42 years old, though he looked much younger. He was a deep-chested man of slightly less than average height, with a coarse-featured yet handsome face which had a built-in mischievous expression. It was very difficult for Worsley to look stern, even when he wanted to. He was a sensitive, fanciful individual, and the manner in which he claimed to have joined the expedition, whether it was true or not, characterized him perfectly. As he told it, he was ashore in London staying at a hotel when one night he had a dream in which he pictured Burlington Street, in the fashionable West End section, as being filled with blocks of ice through which he was navigating a ship. Early the next morning, he hurried over to Burlington Street. As he was walking along, he saw a nameplate on a door. It read, Imperial Trans-Antarctic Expedition. The expedition's London office was, in fact, at 4 New Burlington Street. Inside, he found Shackleton. The two men were immediately drawn to one another, and Worsley hardly had to mention that he wanted to join the expedition.
"You're engaged," Shackleton said after a brief conversation. "Join your ship until I wire for you. I'll let you know all the details as soon as possible. Good morning."
With that, he shook Worsley's hand, and the interview, if that is what it was, had ended. Worsley had thus been appointed captain of the Endurance. That is, he was put in charge of the physical running of the ship, under the overall command of Shackleton, as leader of the entire expedition. Temperamentally, Shackleton and Worsley had some of the same characteristics. Both were energetic, imaginative, romantic men who thirsted for adventure. But while Shackleton's nature drove him always to be the leader, Worsley had no such inclinations. He was fundamentally light-hearted, given to bursts of excitement and unpredictable enthusiasms.
The mantle of leadership which fell to him on the trip across the Atlantic did not rest too comfortably on his shoulders. He felt it was his duty to play the part of commander,